Today we begin our study of Baroque music, which is actually very a helpful moment in this class, because Baroque music is the beginning of what some people describe as the common practice period, which is just a fancy way of saying that this is the music of a sort that we still listen to today, and that still, we will still hear regularly in concerts. Perhaps a little bit more technically, we could say that the common practice period, which begins in the Baroque sort of in the very late 17th century, brings in certain techniques which composers will continue to use really all the way till today in some ways. So it's a nice turning point. It's a nice point for us to hang out on, because I think it gives us a lot of new things to think about. And to understand what they developed in the Baroque, I actually want to turn your attention back to some earlier music we studied together, because we're going to meet the same sorts of musical principles in the Baroque that we see developing nascent in much earlier pre-common practice music. And so I want to turn your attention back to, first of all, to polyphonic music of Josquin and Palestrina. Now, we talked about a number of things with those two composers, but one of the things we talked about in the music of both of those composers is imitation. And I said that imitation is a really wonderful thing, and I tried to point out to you how wonderful it was. You seemed to enjoy it, that you made the appropriate sort of noises to suggest that you might. And imitation is wonderful because it helps us to know what we need to listen for moments before we hear it. You know, hominimus volumus. You remember that idea, that one voice does something and the other one imitates it, and that prepares us then to hear the second voice. But I could have equally pointed out another feature of imitation which makes it very satisfying, and that is that it makes two voices separate from one another and asks us to compare their relationship. Right? But that's one of the nice things about imitative music, is that it gives us relationships to compare. That's how meaning is borne out in so many things in nature, right? And in the created world that man makes for himself. That we notice one thing relates to another thing. And so imitation allows us to stack voices against one another. You remember, in the Palestrina piece, how we could hear one voice following after the next on each of those points of imitation. We could see how those voices relate to one another. Well, the Baroque makes a significant advance on this by making each voice idiomatic, making each voice distinct from one another in very clear ways. I bet that you had trouble in Josquin and in Palestrina hearing the differences between those voices. If I were to say, now is that the alto or the tenor you're hearing here? You would probably struggle to say which it was. Maybe not so much if I said, is this the soprano or the bass? Right, one's really low and one's really high, but you would find that hard. Baroque music does certain things to make it easy for us to hear the difference between the different voices in its music, and that allows us to make comparisons more readily. We can say, that's a clarinet, that's an oboe. In other words, it makes music idiomatic. Now, you'll notice that I transitioned seamlessly from talking about voices that we sing, to instruments. And that's a kind of musician's trick. I mean, musicians tend to talk about particular voices in the symphony orchestra, right? And so, like, a French horn might be one of the voices in the texture of the orchestra. Understand that that's just a kind of façon de parler. It's kind of an easy way of using words to help us to make sense of things, but it's not meant to confuse you. So Baroque music is particularly idiomatic. It emphasizes particular instruments as they relate to one another. And I want to begin with that as we look at this very well-known piece by Antonio Vivaldi. About Vivaldi, I have time to say almost nothing. I mean, he's a Venetian composer, worked among other places for a girls' home and a girls' orphanage, and it was mostly these girls that he uses as instrumentalists. He developed a very thriving concert community there. He wrote a number of operas. I wish we had time to talk more about that, but we'll talk about opera later in this class. So Vivaldi is an important Baroque composer. He's one of the fairly well-known ones. And enough about Vivaldi. The piece you listen to today is the first movement of his Spring Concerto. And it's this notion of concerto that I want to return to as we think about the way voices are distinguishable from one another. Because the heart of the concerto is that it separates individual voices within the texture of the orchestra or the ensemble and pits them against one another in a kind of dialogue. And this can be done in a number of ways, but the most conventional way of doing it is to have a soloist, which we call solo, and then everybody else, the tutti, my tutti, tutti frutti ice creams, probably, it's kind of gross, I don't like it, but some of you may, and if you do, you know the word tutti, okay? So tutti means everything. So solo and tutti are two musical forces, and they're separable from one another. And they relate to each other in dialogue over the course of the piece. This is the way concerti typically work. Now, in the case of this concerto, this string concerto in E major, and the first movement thereof, our soloist is a solo violinist. Now, the solo violinist is meant to be the kind of famous guy, the important fellow who stands in front of the rest of the ensemble, and perhaps even conducts the rest of the ensemble. I think we should assume that this would have been Vivaldi himself, right? I mean, obviously, you know, if you're a composer who wants to take care of your own livelihood, you give yourself a chance to show off. And so he probably is the soloist, at least the premiere of this piece. And he, you know, he will be standing in front of the ensemble playing the important bit. I want you to listen then how long it takes us for this important soloist to enter. He doesn't come in right away. In fact, he seems to lag back for some time. This is the tutti, and that's the whole ensemble. It's just strings and a harpsichord. And we still haven't heard our soloist play on his own. And we still haven't heard our soloist play on his own. And we still haven't heard our soloist play on his own, right? And here he is standing in front of everybody, and we wonder why we paid him more than everybody else. But notice. He steps in, and he cuts them off, right? Did you notice how as the piece begins, we get... Ya da da ba di da 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 yum yum da 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 da. Right. So the before the tutti can actually finish their phrase, which is supposed to end ya da da bum di da 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 da, the violinist, the soloist, has stepped in. We get ya da da bum di da 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 ya da da. Right. He finishes the phrase for them. But that's not all that's happened here. Back up. We're gonna listen to that again. You notice there's a strange intruder into the solo part from the ensemble itself. All right, here's them finishing, and our soloist. Do you hear that? Do you hear that works, right? Somebody is cutting it on his turf, right? So the soloist opens his phrase with ya da, and but from the ensemble we hear ya da da, na da 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 da. They begin to dialogue, but there begins a dialogue between the soloist and actually it's the first violinist. It's the probably the best player that Vivaldi had at his disposal, other than himself. He puts in the ensemble. And he says, okay, we'll give you something interesting to do. Now, there is a reason why he does this that has to do with string. And we're going to hear that at the end if there's time. But I don't want to come to that too soon. For now, what you can notice is that there's a soloist who's a little late arriving, and at the same time, who has a discussion with somebody who's not even supposed to be discussing, right? So Vivaldi's already advanced the notion of the concerto. Concerto is not something Vivaldi invents. He has these already. Concerto is just a piece of music with different instrumentalists relating to each other. But Vivaldi advances this by giving us not just a clear relation between solo and tutti, but here, in fact, a member in the tutti relating back to the solo. Let's hear that again. I'm going to start from the beginning. Soloist. He kind of spits on his bow. He's ready to go. And then we have this dialogue. And notice how long the dialogue goes on. It goes on for a full minute, which is a pretty significant portion of this piece. They're still doing it, right? You hear, we're hearing two violins, and one does one thing, and the other one responds to it. Alright, now that one's doing it. And there's still. And so the TG has to come in and break it up.
Boom.
Alright. Calm down, you two. Alright. And the TG keeps the stage. That is how the TG keeps the stage. And this is important for reasons I get to explain. But notice that the 2D commands the attention for longer than we might expect. And so where's our soloist? I almost want to say our soloists. Because I feel like we have two, right? They're still not here, right? Still 2D. And it's at this point the solo normally interrupts, and the solo steps up to interrupt, but he doesn't. Still 2D. And solo. 2D. Solo. And now we have the solo between 2D and solo as it's supposed to be, right? 2D, solo, 2D. We have the words kind of playing at the same time, but quite distinguishable from one another, right? And a 2D. So in that instance, we have something much more, we might say, traditional. We have a 2T that commands the stage for some time, and then the soloist comes in, and there's this dialogue between solo and 2T, solo and 2T. Now, what they're doing in this dialogue is every bit as important as the fact that they're dialogue. Obviously, it wouldn't be much of a play if you only had two characters dialoguing about nothing. Well, I guess it's like Seinfeld, but you get the idea. And so we're going to talk about what they're doing in a minute. But let's just notice that they're obviously dialoguing. They're obviously dialoguing back and forth. And now it's time for the soloist to have his own little period without the Tutti's intervention. But you'll notice that we're back to the same old joke, that our soloist, when he plays on his own, is interrupted. And I think you'll be able to hear how that happens. Our soloist. See how now that violinist is imitating a soloist, and now they're back and forth, and so the Tutti comes back and interrupts. Right there. Right? One more chance for the soloist to shine here. Oh, she can play it too. Yeah. Between instrumentalists that the Broke gave us, it would have given us much, right? That's a pretty significant advance on the kind of interrelationships we met in Joscan or Palestrina. It's much clearer to us that there are forces toing and froing really throughout this piece. And that helps us that helps us to make sense of it better. I mean, it's really no surprise that the Broke would give us this. Remember, the Broke is the age of drama. And what is essential to drama? Dialogue, right? So we have these dialogical events happening throughout the piece. But, of course, as I've already alluded to, if it were just dialogue about nothing, that would not be very interesting. Broke gives us something even more interesting when it gives us something to dialogue about. And I think to show you what that is, I need to introduce something that develops during the Broke, which is key. This is a theoretical issue in music, which is familiar to many of you. But even though it is familiar to many of you, I want to talk through it because I think it's sometimes a little misunderstood, and I think its potency is certainly easy to neglect if you don't think about what key really does in music. So let me explain to you what key is. To do so, I want to bring your mind back to chant. When we talked about chant, we talked about a final. We talked about this note that we would continue to return to in the chant, right? We would come back to again and again throughout the chant. And that note had a certain sense of gravity, right? So you remember that sense of pull that the note had. The Hallelujah. We came back to that note. We felt like we'd really arrived at something. Well, the reason why we feel like that is largely to do with emphasis. But in the Baroque, composers began to organize the notes of the scale in such a way that those emphases are more emphatic, right? And so we get really just a few scales developing. This one. And you hear how that one obviously emphasizes this note as a note of priority, right? But then we do more than that, more than developing a handful of scales as the kind of the final ones or the fundamental ones. We then infer chords, whole sets of notes above each of those notes, right? So this one, and this one, and this one. Each note has an implicit chord suggested by it, and composers begin to exploit that to develop keys. And keys give us a place of home, which is much more emphatic than merely a final. And you can hear that, right? So obviously, I'm gonna sit down, not because I'm tired, but because it's just easier to play piano. You hear how much more satisfying that return is than even, right? There's more to it. That's because there are more tendency notes in this chord that wants to come down to here, and that wants to go up to here. So key gives us a much more emphatic sense of homecoming when we do come home. And better still, we can change keys to establish temporary homes, which we can learn to sort of like and then move away from. Let me show you how that works, right? Let's do this again. That's an obvious home. Right, so I set up for you a temporary home there, which you were almost as satisfied with as you were with the original home. And then only when you realized how temporary it was, when I did, then you realized that in fact that was your real home. Do you see how that works? Key allows us not just a stronger sense of home, but a sense of giving new places a sense of home, establishing a sense of departure, which is actually kind of strangely satisfying, and then a return, which is even more satisfying. Now, that has been happening all along through this piece. Whether you're aware of it or not is anybody's game, but I want to make you aware of it now, make you rationally aware of something that I think that you're already intuitively aware of. So let's have a listen. This piece is in E major. The home key is here. Stuck in E major. He's going to do that on purpose because actually what he's trying to do for us is give us an unnatural sense of stagnance or stasis for the a purpose that's going to become clear as I kind of explain this. But let me just say that what you're about to hear is, from a key point of view, about as boring as serious music gets. We're going to get stuck in E major for a very, very long time. In fact, only on one chord for the whole of basically a whole minute, right? And that's very odd. But you're going to see how that makes the change of key much more striking when it comes. Here we go. So we're still now in E major. And if you don't believe me, as I doubt you do, let me show you. E major. See how we're stuck? That's more boring than Kesha. At least she changes chords. We're still stuck, right? And we're still in E. We're still in E major. But we're not going to stay there. Watch this. First moment at which we move to a completely new key, and that's going to set into action a set of other movements. We gotta find our way back home at that point. Once we establish a new home, we've gotta realize that that's actually not home at all, and we have to start moving from key to key, and you're gonna hear that in a moment. But it's pretty clear that we've already moved to a new key there, right? Now, watch this. There's a reaction to this. The whole ensemble sort of wakes up to the fact that we moved to the wrong key, and there's a kind of crisis, just like in any other normal drama, where something bad happens. It's not necessarily bad, but you need it for the drama, right? Here we go. Response. Right? Now yeah, that's not good. Then we move to another key. And then we move to another key. You hear how that works? And then we move to another key. And then we move to another key. And then we move to this one. And wait, we're building up to something here. Is this our home key? Here it comes. Here. So was that our return to our home key? Manifestly not. It was obviously not a return to our home key. But not only was it not a return to our home key, it was minor mode, right? So our home key was this. But what we just heard was this. I'm gonna kind of camp it up a little bit. Spooky, right? It's minor mode. Now, minor mode has lots of different associations in music, but whatever those associations, it's less stable for physical reasons. I don't have a lot of time to explain that, but I have to tell you that the major scale is more implicit in every note, in every sound, in fact, than the minor scale. If you don't believe me, watch this. I'm going to depress one key, and I'm going to hold another one down so it'll resonate. Watch this. I'm going to press a C, and you're going to hear a G. Louder. It's just not resonating very well, is it? You hear it, right? How about E? You hear it? Right? So every note has implicit in it the major scale. It does not have the minor scale implicit in it. And so the minor scale is unstable physically. That's why it feels a little spooky to us. But it also tends to be associatively spooky. I mean, people tend to use it for the kind of haunting music. And that's a later phenomenon, but it means basically the same point here. My point is pretty well understood, that not only have we navigated through key after key after key after key in our wanderings back to E major, we actually find ourselves not in E major, but in C sharp minor. Not that you need to know that it's in C sharp minor, but you definitely hear that we're not in our home key. So now it's time to get our butts back home. Let's see how it goes. The soloist is going to start the adventure. But we haven't left C minor yet. We're still in C sharp minor. It's up to the tutti to fix this problem. They're the ones who made it. They're here and E. We're home. One more suggestion that we might leave. No? E, and we're home. It's done. And so obviously all that's left to do is celebrate. What does celebrate sound like? This. Two simultaneous but very different intellectual experiences. Some of you will be saying, I can see on your faces, wow, I didn't know any of that was going on. I didn't notice that there were these changes in keys in this piece of music. Now, I have to tell you that this is something that all serious music does. Most people use key to create a sense of space and therefore narrative, a sense of there and back again. But your second intellectual experience is probably something along the lines of, but if I didn't know that any of that was happening, like, why was this any, why does this matter, right? Why would this matter at all? Many people wonder whether key, I mean, when they first meet it like this, whether key isn't one of these kind of esoteric, theoretical events that doesn't have any bearing on our enjoyment of music. Well, let me put it to you like this. What if you had, as a child, never been given the names of colors? Your parents didn't tell you the names of any of the colors. And so you went your whole life just not really having a word that would associate a red delicious apple with a stop sign, right? You just didn't have that word. Do you think, therefore, that your brain would make no associations? That you would be really colorblind thereby? No, of course you wouldn't. You wouldn't have the words to describe the comparative experiences you're feeling. Therefore, they would not happen at the rational level. You wouldn't be able to explain to anybody else why you felt that way and that way at the same time when you saw a red delicious apple and a stop sign. But it doesn't mean it wouldn't work on you. It would work on you. You just wouldn't know it was working on you. And that's how key works for many people. For those of us who have lots of special training, we can hear it and name it, and okay, here we're here, and now we're here, and now we're here. But I don't think that it adds to my enjoyment of music that very much, because music's meant to work sometimes at the intuitive level. It's sometimes, so what I would say is that if you're worried because you think, well, that's the first time I've ever noticed that, I would say it's probably not the first time you've ever noticed it. It's the first time you ever had it described for you, right? Very different event, right? And that it may have been working on you all along, and you're not even knowing it, right? So probably worth bearing that in mind before you dismiss key as a useful event altogether. Any questions about that? That's kind of a hard sell. Any questions about that?
When did a full orchestra come into being used as a music piece?
Well, so this is actually not the development we think of like the classical orchestra. We're really just a string ensemble. Okay. But it was in the Baroque that instrumental ensembles began to develop, because it's during the Baroque that people began to think idiomatically for instruments. Of course, Josquin wrote instrumental music, what my PhD supervisor used to call songs without words. After a Mendelssohn piece of the same name. In fact, Josquin didn't really specify exactly which instruments were to play anything, right? You know, anybody can play anything. But obviously that's not the case with Vivaldi. He tells you who's going to play what. So it's during this period that they begin to develop our sense for instrumental music as distinctive from vocal music, and even each instrument's own abilities as distinctive from other instruments. But it'll take us probably another 50 years before we have a kind of more or less set orchestra. Other questions? Right. Now, what I've demonstrated to you at this point is Vivaldi's use of the form of the concerto, which is this dialogue between a solo and tutti, or soloist and a tutti, or whatnot, and his use of key. I want you to be under no misunderstanding here. Neither of those things did Vivaldi invent. Those are things he very much inherited from his predecessors. He's no maverick on that front. These are things that you can meet in earlier musics. But the next thing, I think we could almost say he did invent, the ritornello. I think this is Vivaldi's big contribution. I'm not alone in that. It seems that Bach thought that too. Bach, another and much more famous Baroque composer that we'll talk about a little bit later here. The ritornello is actually a way of, in some ways, tying together some of these things. But let me explain. A ritornello is just a bit of music that comes back again and again in different ways. And because it comes back again, we have the delight of returning to material we know. That's one of the pleasures in music, is coming back to things that you've already heard before, and it gives you that sense of satisfaction. But because it comes back in different ways, it's a bittersweet return when it does so. every return of the ritornello that isn't the return in the exact form you first met it in is a kind of bittersweet return. Now, our ritornello here is something that I think you all knew. And the reason why I think you knew it is because most of you turned to write your answers on the quiz at the precise moment when we heard it. As soon as that came in, all of your heads went down, and you wrote in emphatically yes. So those of you who prepared, those of you who didn't prepare, maybe not so. But that's a pretty good clue that that's our ritornello. That's the bit of music that comes back again and again. But what you're going to see is that it does not come back the same way every time. So let's see how that works. Let's begin at the beginning again. And we'll have this opening idea. And that gets repeated. And then finally we have our ritornello, and that's this. Pay attention when composers repeat things back to back like that, because they're clued to say, pay attention to this because you may hear it again later. Now, I want to say a word about our ritornello. It's actually a pretty good melodic idea, especially as it relates to this piece. Let's think about it. I'm going to slow it down and isolate it. So what's happening here? Well, we're hanging out on this note. That's not the home note. This is. Right? So the melody hangs out way up here, not down here. You see how flirtatious it is on that note? It kind of dances around it. And then finally, do it right. Right, and we finally fall off of it. Now, I haven't said a word about spring yet, and I don't plan on doing so until the very end of this discussion, but if you will think with me about spring, it does sort of hang on for a long time before it finally commits, doesn't it, right? So we got this. Finally find our way back down. So it's a fairly useful melody as a ritornello. It also emphasizes this note, right? Which is, of course, the second key that we, the first, our first point of departure is B, right? And that's that note, right? So we're kind of set up for the fact that we're going to depart to that key bum ba dee da dum. We're going to depart to that eventually. And in fact, we will depart to that, as we'll see. All right, so that's our ritornello. Then it goes away. It goes away for a whole stinking minute, and we just hover on this E major chord, right? And this is to build up our eagerness for the return of the ritornello, because it goes away. Not only does it go away, but it goes away and leaves us with static music, where soloists and first violinists dance around playing this bird song in a very indulgent sort of way. Notice what happens when the ritornello finally comes back. We are so glad to get this thing back and just get out of that. Right? And here. Right. Now, our key change begins. Not right away, with Sunny, but we're meant to be. Went back to E. So we stay home. No new key, not the home key, but the new key. Not the home key, but the new key. Not the home key, but the new. And then we get this. Da 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 da. You recognize it? That is not only a new key, but it's our ritornello brought into the new key, right? Now that's a bittersweet return. The first time we got the ritornello back, we were kind of glad to get it back, you know? Sorry, that's pretty rough, but you get the idea. But then we change keys and we get this. Right? And that's not the same as. How that works. So we're getting our ritornello coming back in a second key. That's a bittersweet return. It's like going home, maybe you went home over break and discovering your dad's growing a mustache, right? Like, oh, I thought I knew this. Why? You know, why does this happen? So it's kind of like that. We get a very bittersweet return to the ritornello. No wonder then that we have a musical crisis. The crisis is not just a response to the fact that we've lost our home key, but the fact that we dragged our ritornello into the new key, right? Have this. And so we go searching from key to key in hopes to recover our home key and our ritornello there. But that's not what happens. Instead, we move to a minor key, to C sharp minor. Watch this. And what do we get in C-sharp minor? Listen. You recognize it? So we get the ritornello. We get the ritornello back in C-sharp minor. That's the worst of all, right? It's like your dad, like coming home, not just to find your dad as a mustache, but to find your dad's like decided to take up like some really obnoxious hobby, like playing drum set at 1 o'clock in the morning. Oh, dad, the midlife crisis. What next? We gotta find our way back home. And the soloists, bless them, they try, but they don't achieve it. So the soloist tries to turn. And the first violin comes in to join him. But they're still in C-sharp minor, right? So now what? Ah, the 2 key. No, thanks, sir. Now we have our home key back. All we need is our ritornello back. And the piece is done. But we gotta wait for it. So that really is a Vivaldian contribution. I mean, the ritornello really makes key more emphatic by dragging old material into new keys, and then finally bringing that old material back to its original key. We get a stronger sense of drama. I mean. Any questions about any of that? Okay, well, the moment we've all been waiting for, something about spring, right? We're all really waiting for spring. I understand that. I haven't said anything to you about it just yet, because often bringing this matter into the discussion early means that that's all that people think about. This piece is unusual for the Brook in that it has a little poem that circulated with it to give us some ideas to think about while we listen to music. Extra musical ideas. We call that program music. Program music's any extra musical association that we're given by the composer to kind of bring with us as we listen to music. Vivaldi gives us a poem about spring. And I'm going to give you the section of that poem that has to do with this first movement. I'm going to show it to you here on the board. What we're going to see is that though this piece has had lots of musical meaning that we've already seen up to this point, it also can be very handsomely co-joined with some verbal meaning, right? And I think you're going to see pretty easily how it relates to that. What I want you to be very careful not to do is assume that the verbal meaning is it, right? Obviously, up to this point, we have seen a great deal of musical meaning, and I want to just add this in like gravy on top, right? But not to let it overbear the ship. So let's listen again. I think this is going to be easy enough to see. So we'll call this Joyful Spring, right? And it's pretty cheery. I've shown you how the ritornello is actually spring-like, and that it hovers on the fifth scale degree and then finally comes down. All right, now, how about this? Birds. This explains to us why we have an intrusion from the ensemble, because no bird talks to himself, right? Birds always talk to other birds, so we need another bird. And she steps up, Vivaldi's most handsome or useful violinist, whichever it's going to be. Gentle breezes flow with a sweet murmur. Now, isn't it the breezes that really signal change in the weather, right? Not the birds, but the breeze. And what do brooks do? Well, they meander, they travel. And so we're traveling to a new key. Pumpy, new key, pumpy, new key. And the breeze has brought in something new, a new key, right? But of course, April showers, spring May flowers, we need storms. The sky is covered with a black mantle. Lightning. Thunder. Lightning. Thunder. Lightning. Thunder. It's not hard to hear that, I think, right? Our bird. Does it have a fellow? Ah, yes. The other one. And away we go. To deal with the words, it'd be like sound effect. It'd be pretty boring, right? But you see that it's a piece that has all this musical meaning, and then we can then put this on top of. It's kind of fun. Any questions about that? You see how that works? All Well, I have to tell you that it only gets better from here. Unfortunately, it only gets harder from here too. So brace yourself for Bach. He's not that easy.